And as many of you know, this is going to be my last Ecology Hour, at least for a while. And I wanted to wind up this long Ecology of War series with what I'm finding to be really a underreported story, and that is the issues of robotics and aerial drones and all of these technologies that we have created that are able to be present without a human there. And so I was very fortunate to have the offer of Peter Lumsdaine, our guest this evening, who is going to be further introducing himself. He is the Educational Outreach Coordinator for AROS, the Alliance to Resist Robotic Warfare and Society. Peter, I know you're traveling around and out there on the road. Thank you so much for giving us your time this evening.
Thank you, Deborah, very much for the invitation. Glad to be here.
Please let our listeners know more about you and how you came to this work.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think as you said to me earlier, I think that the telling of the stories that led us on a journey to a particular place and an important place in all of our lives are worth sharing. And so, as you invited me to, I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk about the journey that brought me to the work that I'm now doing with AROS, as you mentioned. And at the beginning of that, I'm just going to say maybe 30 seconds about my family, because that's also important to me. My grandparents grew up as backwoods farmers and loggers with no indoor plumbing, electricity, telephone, anything in the woods of eastern Canada. And I remember very much as a child listening to their stories about that life, which was difficult but very deeply rewarding in their very tight-knit backwoods community there. And I think that had a very, very strong, made a very strong impression on me as I was growing up. My folks actually met when they were working for the U.S. military, and they both worked and served overseas in war zones outside of the United States. And yeah, we were very close. Many of the concerns about peace and global justice that I have, you know, came from my folks and their concerns. I myself, you know, after I finished my degree at UC Davis years ago, I worked for a while for the Department of Energy's very small renewable energy program. I also worked in natural food businesses, private business. But more and more, I gravitated to nonprofits, and I worked for a number of nonprofits, including Global Exchange and the Mobilization for Survival, and then 5 years as the Latin America Program Coordinator at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And that work has taken me all around California, all around the United States, to a lot of small towns and big cities, and also to a number of other countries. I've been very fortunate to have had the opportunity to not only visit, but meet with grassroots organizers and people involved in journalism, in campesino organizing, in labor organizing, in human rights observer missions and work in Guatemala, but much more than that, in Mexico, in the Philippines, some in the Middle East, in Jordan, and in occupied Iraq. And so that's also had a huge influence on my thinking, just having that opportunity to meet with and talk with and interview and try to work in cooperation with people who are organizing in countries that are in some ways very, very similar to our own and in other ways very, very different. So just to cap that comment at the end there, you know, I think that specifically the 8 or 9 different trips that I have made to Mexico, mostly south central Mexico, Oaxaca, Guerrero, Mexico City, Chiapas, and also in the north to Sonora, Sinaloa, meeting with people in churches, in unions, in campesino farm labor organizing, in human rights monitoring, as I say, was very, very important to my perspective as it developed. And my wife, Meg, who is a Mennonite pastor, and I went twice to occupied Iraq, once at the end of 2003, and once with the Najaf Emergency Peace Team, which I organized in 2004 when Najaf was surrounded by the U.S. military. And again, the contact there with those grassroots movements, especially the Shiite social movements in southern Iraq, which are connected to Shiite movements all over the region, was a very big influence and the work that I did after it. AROS itself, Alliance to Resist Robotic Warfare and Society, was started in 2009, and I co-founded that with a number of other people, including the late Gene Stoltfuss, who was involved at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. He served for 16 years as the director of Christian Peacemaker Teams with protective accompaniment groups in Colombia and Haiti and Chiapas in the West Bank, in Iraq, and so forth. So Gene came out of that CPT experience, and we were both co-collaborators in founding this very loose but I think important emergent network, AROS, Alliance to Resist Robotic Warfare and Society, which is definitely focusing over the last several years that it's been around in its educational work, presentations, gatherings, strategy meetings on the challenge of drones, but also looking at drones as the tip of a much larger iceberg. This, what we believe, is a looming robotic, biotech, nanotech age that's coming at us of more and more sophisticated autonomous machines and synthetic organisms. So we try and look at that entire picture and empower people to understand that, to organize around that, to educate themselves and others, and to develop strategies of effective resistance to at least curb, limit, and put boundaries on this new wave of history that's coming at us. So,
and some of us,
I guess that's kind of the summary that I would share at the moment. Yeah.
And some of us who might ask, why is this on the Ecology Hour? I am going to posit that this proliferation, this incredible explosion and expansion of the relationship between robotics and the nanotech and biotech technologies actually has the capacity to threaten the biological fabric of life. And because we're already well into the show, I want to start with the places that I think people naturally think about when we talk about unpersoned aerial surveillance vehicles, otherwise known as drones. And I'd like you to offer a brief synopsis of how our government is spending money and using these technologies and supporting the military-industrial complex in Pakistan, Yemen, and in Iraq.
Right. And if I might just comment also, I mean, I think that the ecology of war theme is a very, very appropriate one. And the more we look into it, the more we see that destructive resource extraction practices all over the world are enforced by military means, and that the military itself has enormous impact on the biosphere, including this new wave of drone and robotic weaponry. So in terms of the question that you asked, you know, drones and other robotic weapons have been a very fast-rising sector of the U.S. military. P.W. Singer at the Brookings Institution, who wrote a very definitive book about this 2 or 3 years ago called Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, points out that when we first got involved in a very direct way with U.S. military forces in Southwest Asia after 9/11, around the time of 2002 and 2003 with Afghanistan, Iraq, and then this spreading network of other conflict areas, that at that time, we had only a handful of UAVs, unpiloted aerial vehicles, that were operational in the U.S. military, and none of them were armed. And that within just a period of about 6 or 7 years, between 2002, 2003, to 2009, 2010, that had grown from, as I say, a handful to over 7,000 operational military drones. In 2010, I believe, was the first year when the U.S. military was training more drone operators than pilots. That would be pilots of fighter planes, bombers, tankers, helicopters, all piloted aircraft put together by that year had been surpassed by the number of drone operators that were being trained. So this has been a very rapid evolution. And as I'll mention a little bit later in the show, the acceleration of robotic military devices on the ground, which is much less known, has been even faster. But we'll come back to that later. So, you know, these drone operations have become a very, very significant part and priority of the U.S. military, even as they tighten or trim some other programs the drone budget and drone operator training sector is very rapidly expanding in the military. This is supposed to be the wave of the future, as I say, with pilots becoming less and less important who are actually in aircraft and being replaced by these people behind computer consoles at Creech Air Force Base and many other places on the ground. So that, and of course, more and more budget priorities are shifted in that direction. So this is very significant to realize that this is the accelerating future direction of the U.S. military, at least in the air. We'll talk about the ground and naval parts of that later. I don't know if that addresses the question. Also, I will just say, but I won't get into it until you inquire further, there have been many controversies surrounding this, including specifically the targeted killing of people on the ground in Southwest Asia, in Pakistan, Yemen, and other areas. There, Iraq as well, and the civilian casualties that have continued to mount from those drone strikes in that region.
Yeah, and just this week there was targeted killings of Palestinians in Gaza by the Israelis,
right,
on their motorcycles. Very effective targeted killings. I want to maybe back up and let people know. First of all, I want to give a huge shout out and my deep appreciation to one of my great, great sheroes, Medea Benjamin. She has recently written a book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. And she was very involved with a whole lot of other people in creating a drone summit in Washington, D.C. recently. And it was following the workings of that summit that made me feel compelled to do this show. You had the amazing experience of being at that summit. Could you speak about that briefly, please?
Yes. Well, first of all, I just want to say that I know that Medea has put tremendous work into this issue, and also what may not be as well known is that even within the past year, Medea also traveled to Bahrain in the Persian Gulf with Bahrain Witness, and in fact, the picture of her on the back of her book, Drone Warfare, which I'm looking at right now, is of her standing with a group of Shiite women, unarmed Shiite women in the streets of Bahrain facing down the security forces there. And so, you know, Medea has a long, long history of this kind of work. I met Medea about 15 years ago when I was working at Global Exchange, and I've really valued that opportunity to get to know her over the years since then. But this summit in D.C. was sponsored by several organizations, including Code Pink, and it was a meeting of people from throughout the United States, several countries in Europe, especially the United Kingdom, England, and also delegations, very significantly, from Pakistan and from Yemen. And so the International Drone Summit, which took place there in D.C. at the end of April, was something which I think all of us who were involved and participated in that felt was a very important opportunity to come together and talk about this key challenge of our age, this increasingly automated drone warfare. And I think that the presentations by people who had been on the ground there in Pakistan and Yemen, the Center for Investigative Journalism, and particularly the Pakistanis and Yemenis who were there, attorneys and human rights monitors and people who are trying to establish a strong public case and legal case for the victims of drone strikes, were a very important voice, you know, in those discussions. I think that summit is a step in the process. I think there have been other conferences, gatherings, and strategy meetings that have also been very important, and I think there have to be more in the future. In fact, later on we'll talk about a conference that's coming up in California this autumn. But that international meeting was one which really brought together people from different sectors and different countries, including some people who, you know, were not entirely opposed to military drones. We did, you know, engage in some conversations with people connected to the U.S. military, connected to corporations that are involved in drone production. It's hard for those people to come to those meetings, but some of them did. And so I think that was also an important aspect. And I'll just add as a final note on that, that was also something that we experienced a couple of years ago in Hood River, Oregon, which is the site of Boeing's Scan Eagle drone facility there. And so AROS and Columbia River Fellowship for Peace organized a conference there in 2010, about 125 folks, and the first speaker was a robotics engineer who founded the drone company that Boeing later snapped up, Dr. Tad McGeer. And so there again, you know, we are trying to not compromise what we believe, but to reach out to and engage in dialogue people who are coming from inside the robotics industry and the drone industry itself.
Peter Lumsdaine, you're listening, you're speaking to an audience that's moving around. So why don't you take this opportunity to give out your contact information and perhaps reference the Santa Barbara conference later so that people who maybe can't listen to the whole show will have that information?
Right. So the best way to contact Arrows, and we are very interested in hearing from people who have comments or concerns or want to be involved in this work, or are interested in this October conference that I'll mention in a moment, is simply by our email, which is in Spanish, actually, so I'll say it and then spell it. It's tierralinda@live.com, tierralinda@live.com, means beautiful earth in Spanish, but that is the best way to contact us. And just to footnote this, though we'll talk about it more later, this October 18th through 22nd, there is a California statewide, even West Coast, but particularly California statewide, organizing and strategy conference about challenging robotic weaponry, challenging the robotic warfare age, through education, through resistance, and through other organizing strategies in Santa Barbara, California. That's going to be October 18th through 22nd. If folks are interested, please send us an email. This is coming right on the heels of a trial in Santa Barbara Federal Court where Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, the releaser of the Pentagon Papers, is now in his early 80s, and 13 other people are going on trial in federal court for a midnight action at Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is a global drone guidance and control center, among other things. They are on the 17th and 18th of October. So the conference will come right after that trial, and it actually falls, as it so happened, not by accident, on the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we think is also significant, another point in our technological history when our sophisticated machinery brought us right edge of global catastrophe, as we believe the drone and robotic warfare industry is now moving the planet in that direction as well. So anyway, that's the conference in October. We'll talk about that more later on.
Yes, I think it's time to bring it back home. So I'd like to direct the next portion of this conversation to talk about home. The U.S. is the largest producer of these various and assorted creations, which I would like you to go into some detail about their variants at some point. We are followed by Israel, and then after that it's China, and then after that it's Iran. But here they are being made extensively. And I would like you to talk about the Air Force bases and their role. Vandenberg has played a very key role. Creech is a place where some very interesting civil disobedience has happened. Hancock is another one. And, of course, those of us who live here in Mendocino County are due west of Beale Air Force Base. But there's, in doing the research for this, I had the good fortune, I'm part of a list that's about drones, people who think drones need to be watched and monitored and that greater legal frameworks need to be made. There's actually a listserv. And on that, there's a whole lot of information about what's going on in North Dakota, where there's very much activity. There's a lot of development. There's actually a four-year degree that one can get at the University of North Dakota. They are experimenting with seven different kinds of unmanned aerial craft. And I'd like you to just basically bring it back home to how do these places that our tax dollars pay and create tremendous cultures around them affect how, first of all, the experimentation and development of these creations are, and also how they manage to kill people in other parts of the world.
Right. Well, you know, there are a wide variety of experimental and operational drones that have been developed. and also ground robotic devices for the military. The ones that we've probably heard the most about are the Predator and Reaper drones, which are armed with Griffin missiles and Hellfire missiles. Didn't make up the name. That's actually what they call them, Hellfire missiles. And those are produced by General Atomics Corporation, which has a major facility in San Diego County and here in California. But, for instance, up in Washington State, as I was referring to a little while ago, in the Bingen, Washington, and Hood River, Oregon area, right there in the Columbia River Gorge, there's a major production complex that Boeing Corporation has. They bought up this drone company in situ and militarized and expanded it. And so they are producing what are called the Scan Eagle drones, which are surveillance drones. The hand-launched Raven drones are also used for surveillance around U.S. military bases and national security zones, as they're called. All of these technologies have been developed and implemented in our military conflicts, our wars in Southwest Asia, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, and more they are coming home to the United States, coming home to California, coming home to Mendocino County, as tools of more and more intensive surveillance of the land and people of this country.
You know, I just want to interrupt because I think this is a very critical point. You were talking about the wars that we're waging in Pakistan and Yemen. Well, we're not officially at war in Pakistan or Yemen. And to me, this is a very big piece of this technology, is that it is allowing us to do far more warlike activities that endanger less American military without ever being officially at war.
Right. I mean, you could make the case that we haven't been officially at war since 1945 because we've gotten into this habit of launching major military conflicts without getting a declaration of war from Congress, which is what the Constitution specifies, but that didn't happen in Korea, it didn't happen in Vietnam, it didn't happen in Iraq, it didn't happen in Afghanistan. So we haven't had a declaration of war since 1945 when that conflict ended. But you're right that even beyond that, there's an increasingly slippery slope. We've seen this with CIA covert operations. We've seen this with U.S. Special Forces covert operations around the world in recent decades. But you are absolutely correct that the drones and this remote control automated warfare makes it easier and easier for us to slip into lethal military operations in areas where the American public has little idea, if any, that we are militarily engaged, and where there has been no formal process of declaring war, seeking approval from Congress in any form. So you're right. I think that is not limited to drones. I think the CIA and Special Forces have been doing this for a long time with other means, but the drones certainly facilitate that and have certainly expanded that kind of borderless, informal warfare that we're conducting. You know, it's interesting to note that as the drone strikes in western Pakistan specifically, and that has been the area that's been hit the most heavily, yes, there have been strikes in Iraq, in Yemen, and even in Somalia on the Horn of Africa, but western Pakistan has gotten, and in Afghanistan as well, but western Pakistan has gotten the brunt of those strikes. And in 2009, for instance, in 2010, there were a number of studies that were done about the civilian casualty rate. And I will say that the civilian casualty rate has dropped somewhat, but it is still a very serious issue. And at that time, when these programs were really ramping up, there were a couple of key studies that were done by the New America Foundation and by the Brookings Institution, both of which are very middle-of-the-road, reputable think tank research outfits. Brookings, particularly, is very bona fide credentials going back to World War I. Well, anyway, they did these studies, and the New America Foundation came up with the estimate that about 30%, which is a pretty high figure, of the people being killed in these drone strikes were unarmed civilians. Grandfathers, grandmothers, moms and dads, kids, babies, in these dirt-poor Pashtun tribal villages along the northwest frontier of Pakistan. The Brookings Institution, which I believe had access to better data and probably was using more accurate definitions, actually came up with a figure as high as 80 or 90% of the casualties at that time. And David Kilcullen, who is a counterinsurgency expert, he's not only an Australian military officer who works at the Pentagon, but he was the right-hand advisor to General Petraeus during the Iraq surge. David Kilcullen testified before Congress and also wrote in the New York Times during that period of time, 2009-2010, that he believed from the data that he had seen as Petraeus' right-hand advisor that these strikes to that point had eliminated 14 to 16 high-ranking militant leaders and in the process had killed over 600 Pakistani civilians, men, women, children, old people, babies, the whole range in these tribal villages. He said, we are creating enemies faster than we can kill them, and we need to call off the drones. This is a guy who is the advisor to General Petraeus, so I think that's pretty significant.
You are listening to this on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, streaming on the web at kzyx.org. This is the Ecology Hour with your host, Deborah Scott. Our guest this evening is Peter Lumsdaine, and we are talking about what, for lack of a better term, are drones. And I wanted to mention this earlier in the hour, but I'll mention it now. I'd like to dedicate this show to the memory of Rachel Corrie. Many of our listeners will know that the courts came down today saying that the Israelis were completely within their rights to kill her with a bulldozer while she was protecting a Palestinian home because she was in a war zone and she put herself at risk. So I'd like to dedicate this show to Rachel Corrie and her family. But along that lines, I'd like to move on to what many of our listeners already know exists thanks to the work of Democracy Now! And others. But let's talk a little bit about the Tuesday morning kill list.
Right. Well, one of the things that has been at issue in this discussion of civilian casualties at the International Drone Summit in D.C. this past spring, this is a major topic of discussion, is how are the victims of these drone strikes, particularly in Pakistan, but also elsewhere, being described or designated? You always hear about militants killed and Islamic guerrillas killed and so forth and so on. And it's come out more and more that this designated kill list, which the president is approving each week for people to go after in these targeted killings, has now actually been expanded. And this has been in the mainstream press. It's been expanded to define any so-called military age male, any man or boy between 15 and 60, as a potential combatant, therefore a combatant, therefore a legitimate military target. So that entire designation of civilians, whether or not people are involved in armed organizations, whether or not they are armed, whether they have any association, because they are in a targeted militant activity zone, and they are a male between 15 and 60 years old, they are a priori a target, legitimate military target, considered guilty until proven innocent. And I think that is one of the most disturbing elements of this designated kill list program. First, they were picking out individuals, bad enough. Now they are picking out patterns of activity, not armed activity, but activity which they claim is suggestive of possible involvement in militant organizations. And that becomes a death sentence for these people by remote control drone strike. Very, very serious and I think very disturbing precedent that's being set there.
And there was a recent poll of Americans that I found quite shocking. In it said that 8 out of 10 Americans polled. Now, I have a lot of distrust of polls. Who were they polling? I don't know. Thought that killing suspected terrorists outside of the United States with drone attacks was just a fine thing to do. And 79 out of 100 Americans thought that killing Americans in drone strikes was also an acceptable choice. I'd like you to just speak to that climate relative to bringing it back home once again and talking about homeland security and the proliferation of this technology as it's being used both through Homeland Security grants to Border Patrol and to various assorted local police forces. Right now, the Republican National Convention being a good example.
Right. You know, several years ago, the Houston, Texas Police Department was caught by local journalists and farmers doing drone surveillance practices in the countryside outside of Houston. And they admitted that, yes, they were ramping up for using drone surveillance of what they called problem neighborhoods in Houston. We all know that these are primarily low-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods of color, that the domestic security forces, for instance, the Houston Police Department, are targeting with this kind of surveillance, and eventually potential strike forces, the drones in the United States, officially at this point in time are not armed, but that is not far down the road if current trends continue.
What's being flown by both Border Patrol and, in some cases, urban police forces actually have the capacity to be armed with whether it's tasers or whatever level of armament is chosen.
That's right. So for some time, they have been flying, quote, unarmed predator drones up and down the southern and northern borders of the United States. That's watching both sides of the border, Canadian and U.S. territory in the north, Mexican and U.S. territory in the south. I know, for instance, I've recently learned that in Mendocino County, there is a discussion that's going on, and this discussion is going on in other areas about the very serious problem of environmental problem and human rights problem and violence problem of very ruthless drug activity, cartel activity in the forest. This was happening in Washington State when I lived up there for almost 3 years. In the Northwest, I know in Northern California, particularly Mendocino County, this is a very great concern. And I know that it's one of the arguments that's used to say, well, we need to bring in these, at the moment, unarmed surveillance drones to track down these bad actors and try and control this problem. But I think we always need to remember that that which is introduced for a arguably legitimate or worthwhile purpose tends to expand and expand beyond the original purpose once it is put into place. It's the old question of do the ends justify the means? And I think even the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights wrestled with this. There was a reason that very strict limitations were put on the police and surveillance powers of the government, for instance, in the Bill of Rights. And I think it was Franklin who said, those who sacrifice liberty for security will lose both in the end and, in fact, deserve neither. So we've got to be very, very careful, I think, about arguments that are understandable, arguments that are plausible, but I think arguments that are potentially very slippery and dangerous about introducing more and more government control, government surveillance, and also corporate control and corporate surveillance, because a lot of this is intertwined with the private contractors and the industries and the privatization of the security state in this country. Even though there's a problem that people are trying to address, but I think it is a very slippery slope, and this use of surveillance drones across the United States is growing faster and faster. I do want to also, if we could, talk a little bit about the wider field of robotics, how it's impacting military operations on the ground, how it's impacting society, and where this is leading in terms of the global ecosystem, in terms of the interface between robotics, biotechnology, and nanotech. I think that's important that we touch upon that, too. In the show, it's very relevant, I think, to your listeners.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, well, Mendocino County also, of course, and I know you have listeners well beyond Mendocino County, but that is your home base. Mendocino County, of course, has had a very historic role in the banning of genetically modified organisms. It's been difficult to establish that in other counties, other municipalities, but there are some places that have followed Mendocino's lead. And I think that we need to be looking at the idea. In fact, I think there is a model resolution of not only drone-free zones, but also robotics-free zones in this country, sanctuary zones, where if this technology is going to advance in the way that it's advancing, that at least there are some areas that are preserved as sanctuaries from that kind of high technology power. You know, it's very significant, I think, that, as I said, the acceleration of robotic technology and robotic military technology on the ground has been even faster, but less known, than in the air. Like I said, the Brookings Institution study indicated that we had gone from a handful of aerial drone systems, military systems, to over 7,000 in about a seven-year period. Well, in that same seven-year period, in 2002 and 2009, we went from zero operational ground robotic systems to over 14,000 ground robotic systems that are now operating primarily in these Southwest Asia conflict zones. People don't know, for instance, that there are routinely human-robot patrols, joint human-robot patrols that are going out in the military conflict zones of Afghanistan. They were going out in Iraq during the more active phase of U.S. involvement there. These systems are not yet armed officially,
Peter,
but they have developed armed systems. Yes.
I think that we've been speaking in really abstract terms, and so when we get to this point, could you make it very visceral for people? Like, when you talk about on-the-ground robotics that the military is using, describe one or two or three for us so that people, we're not just throwing a word around, that people can understand what are these things and how are they being used.
Right. Well, you have, I think most of us in our culture have an idea of robots and what they look like. And to some extent that is accurate and to some extent it's not. But you have little mechanical, autonomous, tracked vehicles with artificial intelligence, very advanced miniaturized computer systems that are rolling along with visual and optical sensors accompanying these ground patrols on their military missions, their strike missions, for instance, on the ground in Afghanistan. And you have a surveillance capability that then empowers the armed soldiers or special forces strike teams to carry out their very lethal mission more effectively. It's just like the surveillance drones. They may not be armed themselves, but they give the targeting coordinates to the helicopter gunships, to the special forces strike team on the ground that carries out that lethal mission. Like I say, these are generally tracked vehicles, although they are developing also mechanical animals, like what's called the Big Dog from Boston Dynamics Robotics Corporation in Massachusetts, which are actually like mechanical pack animals that are starting to accompany soldiers on their missions into the field. They actually have mechanical legs that walk along the ground. They can run, they can jump over obstacles. And people who have seen videos, for instance, of this so-called Big Dog system, find it quite disturbing. It's almost humorous, but also very spooky to see these metal mechanical animals that can walk, run, leap, accompany human patrols, or potentially act autonomously. Right now, they're officially designed for carrying military equipment, but they have developed very lethal armed systems, which I believe will be released in the next military crisis, the next war right around the corner with the conflict that's building up between the United States and Iran. I think this is going to be the break point where these armed military robots are unleashed on the ground in enormous numbers, because we're going to be in a very difficult situation. So you're going to see in the years ahead, on the ground in the United States, more and more miniature tractor type or animal form or even upright humanoid form robotic machines.
Well, actually,
we'll have a greater and greater artificial intelligence and greater armament at their control.
I saw a posting today on the drone list. I believe it was posted by our dear friend, Colonel Ann Wright. Thank you for your work, Ann. That at the RNC, there are these, they sort of look a little bit like a motorcycle seat running around on wheels. They can go up to 65 miles an hour. These ones aren't armed, but they can be equipped with tasers, and they have very sophisticated cameras and sighting information on them. and they are on the ground running around at the Republican convention. And that all of these types of things that are being used by our police forces in this country are being paid for by us, the taxpayers, who are writing checks to Homeland Security, who is then paying people like Raytheon and Boeing and any number of other companies that are profiteers of war to make these contraptions.
That's right. People who are concerned as well about the imposition of biotechnology in the global south, in California, in many other parts of the world, need to be aware of the fact that for at least the last 12 years, we have been warned, though most people don't understand this yet, that the biotechnology industry and also the new nanotech industry, the microscopic molecular engineering industry, are not only on a very rapidly accelerating path, as is the robotics industry. And the robots are being more and more miniaturized. The micro-drone swarms, MAV and NAV micro-drones, which are getting smaller and smaller and being programmed to operate in swarms like insects, that these technologies are not only accelerating, but they are on a merger trajectory. So, for instance, 12 years ago, Bill Joy, who is the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, he's one of the premier software architects in the world, hardly a Luddite, he wrote an article in Wired Magazine called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, doesn't need software engineers, no, doesn't need human beings and other biological organisms, because there is an entire class of synthetic organisms that is being developed by the merger of biotechnology, nanotech, and robotics in the years and decades ahead, which cast enormous shadows over every form of biological life on this planet. Now, this guy was not, you know, an Earth firster. He was not a peace organizer. This guy is a world-class software engineer publishing in Wired Magazine. And he said that we have got to look at the idea of renunciation, even though he has developed high technology, loves high technology, fascinated by high technology, has become very wealthy from high technology. He says, I've come to the very reluctant conclusion that this is taking us in extremely dangerous directions. So his idea of renunciation is that because we as a society, a group of scientists, engineers, or a society can do something, does not mean that we should. And it does not mean that we inevitably will, that we make choices about what technologies we develop and how far we take that as a society. So I think that's a very important aspect of this whole situation.
And I think you're raising a really important point, which is when we look at who are the already existing players on the map, U.S., Israel, China, Iran, there are 50 countries in total that have drones. And many of our listeners are experts in watching the long, sordid history of nuclear proliferation. I don't see a big difference in the idea of who can do what in terms of having players. And I don't see how the hubris of our current administration can think that we can use this technology to 86 people without ever being on the soil and think that there aren't others who will gain that technology, and what will that mean when we have a more global type of warfare where other countries can do what we are currently doing?
Right. You know, we are on the cusp of a era very similar, but I think even more profound, to the era that we entered in the mid-1940s, the beginning of the nuclear age. You could even go back to the turn of the 19th and 20th century, the beginning of the petrochemical age, the automobile age, and all of these accelerating technologies of the 20th century. Well, we're at another cusp, which is like the dawn of the oil age, the petrochemical age, the automobile age around 1900, or the nuclear age around 1945. With the rise of this huge intensifying robotics complex. And so we need to make some critical choices. And I want to really emphasize that right now, I believe that there is the possibility of steering and changing and limiting the trajectory, the direction that we're on, which is what this conference in October is about, this statewide strategy conference, to bring people together to really develop strategies for education and for organizing and for effective resistance to, if not to stop, to at least limit and restrict the destructive effect of these technologies, robotics as well as biotech and nanotech that are emerging with it. So I think it's a very important moment.
Who might want to come to this conference, Peter?
I think people who are concerned about the environmental impact of technologies, of synthetic chemicals, of synthetic organisms, of military operations, of our oil wars, of these wars that keep fueling the oil age and in all of the climate change and peak oil disasters that are following in its wake. I think we need to look at the technologies that enforce that resource extraction economy and which will accelerate its impact on the environment. I think people are concerned about peace, concerned about human rights, who are concerned about domestic civil liberties, be they on the left or the libertarian right, this increasing surveillance matrix state that's being put down on us, and people who also believe in the power of ordinary folks to change the course of history. We're saying, you know, that we're at a point when we need to go from symbolic protest to effective resistance. One of the reasons we're having it in Santa Barbara is because of this trial that I mentioned. And another reason is because Vandenberg Air Force Base, of all the facilities on the planet that are involved in the military drone complex, Vandenberg is probably the most central because it's at Vandenberg that the signals for the satellites, which communicate with and guide every single military drone in the U.S. and NATO forces, and probably Israeli as well, get their data to fly, stay in the air, and to strike their targets. Vandenberg is the global satellite coordination base for airstrikes and drone strikes all over the planet. And we believe, and we have established, I think, through research and experience, that Vandenberg can be significantly affected by nonviolent direct action. We respect actions that happen at the gates of these facilities, but we're talking about sending teams of people, which has been done before, into this 96,000 acres of coastal chaparral, woodland, and hills, into the off-limit security zones to actually slow down and disrupt those operations in a nonviolent way, a way that does not involve felony charges, a way that doesn't hurt anybody, but that does disrupt and slow down those operations. So this is also an aspect of the organizing that's happening there on the Central Coast and throughout the state.
Could you please give your contact information out again so that anybody interested in the conference can receive more information?
Yes. So people who are interested can contact us at the following email address, which I'll say it and spell it, tierralinda@live.com. That's tierralinda@live.com. So that is the email contact address for the conference and for Arrows, and we'd very much appreciate hearing from people who are interested or would like to be involved in this. We're also doing build-up educational presentations and workshops and discussion sessions around California during the latter part of September and the first part of October to prepare for this conference, and people in Mendocino, in Humboldt, and any other part of California or beyond who are interested in those, you know, should also get in touch with us as well, because we will be doing a tour of those discussions and forums that will build up towards the conference.
So that's a shout out to all you organizers out there. If you have thought this person has got a lot to say and you're interested in educating your community, please contact Peter, and he is now scheduling his tours, his speaking tours, and I would personally really like to see him speaking in at least a couple of places in Mendocino County. Peter, we are coming up rapidly on the end of the hour. It's
right.
Pretty glum stuff we've been talking about, but I know that you have some positive notes you'd like to go out on, if you could keep them brief, please, about what we can do.
Well, I think the fundamental note here is that throughout history, people have gone up against incredible odds in social movements and have made significant changes, from the abolition of slavery to the uprising in Egypt and Yemen and all over the Middle East. You know, often our presentations are titled, maybe ironically, Hope for the 21st Century, because we believe that there is hope, and that, for instance, the people primarily in the global south, who have stood their ground and fought back against the invasion of the biotech industry, people like Vandana Shiva from India, Campesino and Peasants Associations in Mexico, in South America, in the Philippines, in India, and elsewhere, have really, I think, set an example for us. I know when I was in Mexico that the poorest people, the most impoverished Campesino villagers in Mexico, were at the forefront of the environmental protection movement and resisting the deforestation of the southern Sierra Madre when I was there in Guerrero and Oaxaca. And so I think we have an enormous amount to learn from these movements and an enormous history to draw on, that when people join hands and work together and stand their ground and resist the forces of destruction, that they can really make an impact. That's what this conference is all about. And I'd just like to end with this quote from a really great British folk band called Seize the Day, Shannon Smee and Theo Simon, in their song about the mass workers' uprising that occurred 200 years ago in central England, now called the Luddites. They say at the end, when they talk about this movement and what it accomplished and what it did not accomplish, they flash forward to the 21st century and they say, some call it futility. They say the future will be what the engine of progress demands. But Ludd called humanity back to reality. We weave our destiny with our own hands. So I'd just like to end on that note and really invite everybody to get in touch, to participate in this conference and action at Vandenberg. And thank you so much, Deborah, for all of your work and for inviting me to be part of the show.
Thanks very much, Peter Lumsdaine. Have a good evening, and thank you. The very best to you.
You too. The very best to you.
So this is coming to the end of my last Ecology Hour, and I just wanted to give a shout out to some of the sources that have really inspired me and keep me going. And if you're interested in following the sorts of topics that I've covered on this show, there's a few places I encourage you to check out. Most of them, unfortunately, do require having a high-speed internet connection, but I regularly listen to the Flashpoints news show on KPFA. You can just Google Flashpoints, and it is archived. You can listen to it when you feel like it. I'm getting a lot of interesting world coverage off of Al Jazeera English online. I don't personally find the half-hour news they do on the radio very interesting, but if you tune in at different times, like Saturday morning, really early, they have this amazing program on environmental solutions that are going on around the world. Very interesting stuff I don't see covered anywhere else. I want to remind people about the non-GMO project, anyone who wants to inform themselves relative to upcoming Prop 37. Of course, you all know I'm really big on 350.org, and 350.org, who are tireless in the climate change issue, have a petition to sign right now, if anyone's interested, that they're sending to Romney. He has not made a single comment about climate change and his position on climate change. So the current 350.org petition is to force him to come out and state his position, if you're interested in that. One of the great inspirations for me in the wholeness of what it means to be a human being struggling to deal with all of these things and love the world is Dr. Gabor Mate. You may have heard him on Amy Goodman. He is going to be speaking as a benefit for Pacifica and KPFA on the 5th of September at the First Congregational Church, which is at 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley, on Beyond the Hungry Ghost in Politics, How Self-Awareness Within Supports Progress Without. If you can hear him speak, he is amazing. It is a benefit for Pacifica. The phone number for information is 510-848-5006, or you can email Bob at kpfa.org. On the nuclear front, regular visits to websites Beyond Nuclear and Fair Winds, which is fair with an E at the end, Associate, that's Arne Gunderson's site. All of these are places that I regularly visit. I think that they offer a lot of information, underreported information. I also want to give a shout out to the folks in Richmond. The whole fiasco in Richmond recently with the explosion and the incredible air pollution, which I'm sure we're getting some version of, was very underreported. And on Flashpoints, you can go to their archives. They just covered a recent public meeting. But there's a group in Richmond called Communities for a Better Environment. And it is one of the really big toxic players in our immediate world. And we can all be aware of it and choose to support those folks.